I'm Rhonda Collister, and I'd like to welcome you to this afternoon's session on For Better, For Worse, For Apostasy, How Faith Issues Affect Couple Relationships. This panel consists of me, my husband Michael Collister, Tom and Paige Kimball, Ruth Ogden, and John Halstead. The genesis of this session occurred last year at Sunstone when I met Paige Kimball. We talked, we introduced our husbands, we shared our stories, and Paige said, there ought to be a Sunstone session on faith and marriage. I said, okay, let's do one next year with our husbands. She gasped, I think she turned a little white, and has been a very good sport in going along with her idea. Then at last year's Sunstone Symposium, there was a session entitled, When Beliefs Lead to Estrangement. At the end of the session, a questioner stood up and said, I'm a facilitator of a post-Mormon group. In our group, when there's a change in religious opinion, it's often met with a lot of fear on the part of the faithful spouse, to the point that people cannot listen to each other. They freeze and back out of the room. They accuse someone of being under the influence of Satan. The questioner then asked the panelists, do you have any suggestions for reducing the fear and tension and enhancing communication? The panelist, Mary Beth Raines, responded, this is a big one, not just because of the fear that someone won't be with you in the next life. Your basic attachment to the person you love and are planning to spend the rest of your life and eternity with is now threatened. This can create a feeling of pulling out someone's cord for breath. It hits people at that depth. I share these quotes with you to illustrate how difficult these changes in faith, belief, or religious opinion can be. Here today, we're each couples that were married in the temple. Mike, Tom, John, and Ruth each serve missions for the church. In many ways, we've been typical LDS families. But today, we want to discuss the challenges of faith changes occurring in one or both partners, and the challenges that these create for the marital relationship. The bios in the program cover the details about our educations, professions, and children. That illustrates we're not experts. We're just here to let others who are experiencing the same things know that they're not alone. We're each going to tell the stories of some of our most difficult experiences in the hopes that maybe something we share will be helpful. I've arranged the program somewhat in order of how much change has occurred in the differences in our religious behavior. While I think all of us have deeply reflected upon our religious and adjusted our religious beliefs over the course of our marriage, some have changed their outward activity more than others. Today, Mike and I will start with our stories, then Paige and Tom, and then Ruth and John will conclude, and we'll try and leave 20 minutes or so for questions and discussion. So I'll start with my story. My spiritual crisis occurred in 1980, after I'd finished my master's degree and was expecting my second child. Growing up in Southern California, I'd been obedient and done all of the right things. Young Women's Awards, seminary, BYU graduation, temple marriage. But as I finished my schooling, I found myself struggling with the question of how to be a mother of young children, while also having abilities and talents that were not necessarily home-centered, and how could I continue to have feelings of growth and progression? One day as I was reading my scriptures, I wanted to find some guidance for me as a young mother. Instead, I became overwhelmed by the maleness of the scriptures, and I began asking, why don't we know more about our mother in heaven? Because I thought knowing more about her would help me find a greater sense of where women fit in the eternal scope of things. My deeper question was really, how can I as a woman feel a sense of being valued both within the church and by God? It was difficult for me to find people that I could talk to that understood my questions. I did not find answers, and my search soon petered out in frustration and fear. This was not long after Sonia Johnson's excommunication, and women seemed cautious about discussing these questions. I gradually put my questions on the shelf in my mind and resigned myself to thinking about them at some future point in time when more information might be available to help me. In 1987, after Mike and I had been married for 11 years and had four daughters, ages 0 to 9, Mike decided he wanted to follow his dream after all and go to medical school. This was the beginning of a 10-year odyssey, the beginning of which had a wrenching effect on our marriage. We were both working harder than we'd ever worked before. We both felt that our efforts at home were not adequately acknowledged and often unrecognized. Mike interpreted my unhappiness as resenting his going to medical school. I interpreted his unhappiness as criticism and dissatisfaction with me and my efforts. As our marriage deteriorated, I felt guilty, depressed, feelings of failure, that I could not possibly do enough. But with the help of a counselor who recommended several good books, I learned things by reading, I was able to learn a lot about myself and recovered from my depression. As I felt better about myself, our marriage also improved. At this time, I attended a pivotal Sunstone Pillars of My Faith session. Listening to Kathleen Flake tell her story inspired me to reopen my questions. Now that I was feeling good about myself and my marriage, I decided it was probably time to try and address my spiritual questions so that I could be better prepared to assist my daughters as they grew and encountered their own questions. I began to look for answers to the question that had eluded me earlier. And at that time, I read all of the feminist theology that I could find in Salt Lake City prior to the internet and Amazon.com. I tried talking to Mike about my search and my evolving thoughts, but I could see the fear in his eyes. And so I mostly stopped talking and had a journey that was largely independent of him. After a year or so of reading, thinking, discussions with others, I started coming to a place where I realized that I needed to decide for myself what I thought. LDS theology did not answer all of my questions. As I tried to find a sense of worth in God's eyes and in the eyes of church, I realized that I could not just keep waiting for the institutional church to address my longing. But I was eventually able to come to some conclusions about what I thought for myself. My search process drew to a close as I began to feel a sense of peace. During the course of my search, I discovered that the original structure of my faith had crumbled into pieces. I no longer knew exactly what I believed. This was unsettling, but I kept plodding forward, re-examining each component of my faith, and slowly reassembling the pieces. After a year of thinking, writing, talking, writing in my journal, I was relieved to find that most of my beliefs were still there. I just put them back together in a new way. My outward behavior remained the same. I stayed active in the church. I just thought a bit differently. Tom Kimball, one of our panelists, building on the work of James Fowler, named this transition moving from we believe to I believe. When I did this, I found a new place of equilibrium. About this time, I was coming to a greater sense of peace in my spiritual journey, Mike finished medical school and started a 6-year surgery residency at the University of Missouri. I was on a high, excited about all that I had learned over the previous few years about myself and about what I thought. And I wanted to maintain this invigorating sense of growth and learning that I was experiencing. So I did a crazy thing and started a PhD program. I spent the next 5.5 years getting my PhD while Mike was doing his surgery residency, and then 6 more years getting tenure at Utah State University, in addition to raising our 4 daughters. These were very intense years. And in the process, I essentially put my spiritual journey on hold, stayed active in the church, but focused primarily on my family and my intellectual journey. I had reached a place of peace spiritually, and I felt comfortable until Mike entered his period of doubt and questioning.
Well, I was going to sing, "I'm a Mormon through and through," but my wife just said, "No way." But I am a lifelong member of the church. My ancestors were converts in the early days, and more or less we've carried that system through until now. I was born in Southern California and lived most of my young life in Reno, Nevada. And although I remain active in the LDS Church today, my personal doctrine is not traditional at all. My life as a Mormon boy in Reno was reasonably normal. The trouble that I did manage to find was not particularly insidious, I guess I should say. I attended Sunday church meetings. I had dedicated youth leaders and teachers. I did not attend seminary until my senior year in high school. And I don't recall ever doubting any LDS teachings. The church was always there, but not really venerated in any personal way. My parents were consistently loving, accepting, and generous with the elbow room that I needed to sort out my faith, and I found that very important. I cannot recall a single discussion about missionary service prior to graduation from high school. Although I had initially no intention of serving a mission, I fell in with the BYU freshman tide moving in that direction, and in 1972, I was bound for the LTM going to Brazil without an energetic testimony and without knowing much about the restored church. And a miracle happened. The LTM was the most spiritual experience of my young life. But the gods smiled upon me, and our visas were delayed a total of 5 months, all of which were spent at Allen Hall in Provo, Utah. And I blessed every minute. I read everything I could get my hands on, as I was seriously deficient in basic restored gospel knowledge. An example, one afternoon I was studying, and I turned to the elder beside me, and I said, "Did you know that it was John the Baptist that came down as a resurrected being and conferred the Aaronic priesthood on Joseph Smith and Oliver Cowdery? Isn't that cool?" And he looked at me like I had just stepped off the mothership. Anyway, the restoration story made perfect sense to me. Jesus communicated to me while I was in the LTM, and I hit the Brazilian ground running, and I never looked back till I got home. In 1976, I married Rhonda in the Los Angeles Temple. 20 months after returning from Brazil, we finished our undergraduate studies at Brigham Young University, and we moved to the Salt Lake Valley. After several years in a small business, birth of four daughters, a mortgage, an MBA for Rhonda, I started medical school at the University of Utah at age 33. After graduation, it was off to Missouri for 6 years of residency and a PhD for Rhonda. Yes, we were absolutely crazy. If I could, I would excise the years 1987 to 1997 from our marriage. It was very tough. And although Rhonda and I both really enjoy our careers, and we both love our children and ourselves more than ever, and our children made it through virtually unscathed, I cannot recommend the path we took to anybody. I am not embarrassed to say we wore out four sets of marriage counselors, and we needed them all. Currently, Rhonda is a professor at Utah State University, and I'm a urologist in private practice in Logan. Those who know me now and have heard my religious ranting and raving wonder why it took almost 30 years to painfully unloose my moorings from the conventional faith, or Fowler's Stage 3. It probably started early with my contemplation that at least part of our canon was in all likelihood mythological. The creation stories, Adam and Eve, Noah and the Flood, never quite fit the observable universe with which I was acquainted, and that the Old Testament could be read and understood in a non-literal, non-factual way was certainly never presented as an option by the church, and hence never entertained. The Book of Mormon, on the other hand, for me, was rock solid, no doubts. Then in the late 1970s, I read Donna Hill's Joseph Smith, the First Mormon, and for the first time, The neat and tidy and official story I'd taught in Brazil was puzzlingly negotiable. We even attended a few Sunstone symposia in those days, and as Rhonda said, that was when she was beginning her religious journey with Mother in Heaven. Still, with regular or reasonably regular reading, the Book of Mormon was literally the keystone of my religion. And as long as it was true, I felt well ensconced within the safety net of the restored gospel. We were active, served in many ward callings, tithed, went to the temple, had occasional family home evening, prayed and read the scriptures daily. So what happened? Well, first, friends, and this is not necessarily in chronological order, but just how I'm going to present it. Friends, some of whom I'd known for decades, started leaving the church. Now, why would anyone leave the church was my question. I was at a loss. Initially saddened, I became interested in why someone would leave something within which I felt so safe. This became a time of intensely personal reflection of many doctrinal issues which I had repressed over the years. Because I was convinced that a religious tradition worth one's devotion would stand the test of scrutiny, I decided to step out of the paradigm and look at the tradition I'd been practicing from the outside. My view by necessity would be my own, and I did not want to involve Rhonda in this potential turmoil, at least not for the present. Second, and this evolved along the same time, my big issue was and still is, to a large extent, the destiny of the innumerable souls who would never prove themselves within a Christian or gospel milieu. The Doctrine and Covenants sections regarding these issues did not begin to account for the wide spectrum of belief systems and convictions among humankind. Was I conceited enough to believe that every devout non-Christian or non-Mormon who had spent his or her entire life developing virtue and faith would learn soon after death that the effort was false, or at least critically inadequate? Third, I took President Hinckley's challenge, and in 2005, the fifth and final year of my bishopric service, along with our ward in Logan, I slowly and methodically reread the Book of Mormon. A few of the stories still moved me, but many did not. Could any man have written this book? For the first time in my life, my answer was, perhaps. There are many other developments, books read, and not a few sleepless nights. I ultimately shared with Rhonda my developing rejection and questioning of various doctrines within our Mormon tradition.
Mike waited after a number of months of agonizing before he finally disclosed to me his doubts. I knew something was wrong. He was withdrawn, down, had a somewhat shorter fuse than normal, and this went on so long that I began to wonder if our marriage was in trouble and he just didn't want to tell me. So that by the time he finally started talking, I was much more anxious and fearful than I would have been had he started talking months earlier. Initially, Mike's disclosure was not too upsetting. I'd been through my own period of questioning and felt that I would understand. I had remained faithful, and I thought that this was probable that Mike might do the same. I also saw that Mike had very few people that he felt like he could talk to. And I knew how valuable it had been for me to eventually find a non-judgmental friend with whom I could explore somewhat unorthodox ideas as I sorted out what I thought. I wanted to be that person for Mike. This became far more painful and difficult for me than I expected as I began to recognize the depth of his questions and doubts. His questions triggered a deep fear in me. Mike asked me on several occasions, "Are you afraid for my salvation?" And I answered no. He was a wonderful man. He was not sinning. I was afraid on a much more self-centered level. I worried about what would happen to us, our marriage, and our future together. It felt as though my dream of sharing both our lives and our beliefs together were threatened and that our paths appeared to be diverging.
One night, I disclosed to Rhonda my doubts about the exclusivity of LDS temple marriage. And while my focus was on a very positive description of one of her brother's non-LDS marriage, including my question of how could God reject their commitment and marriage while accepting ours, Rhonda heard a tacit rejection of our marital vows. Although she'd heard me rant and rave about various gospel subjects in the past and had been a marvelous listener and a sounding board, this one struck precariously close to heart and home.
This was probably the most painful moment for me. When Mike asked, how could I possibly believe in temple ceilings? It felt as though he was questioning our marriage, especially the eternal part. It seemed at that moment that he was talking about divorcing half of me, the eternal half. To his credit, the next day he tried to explain that he was really speaking generically, not trying to challenge me and not referring specifically to our marriage, but more generally to the idea of temple ordinances. But this episode illustrates for me how important it is to be very careful with our language when we're discussing such sensitive issues. Our conversations continued to trigger fear. It was a difficult time for me, but I kept trying to listen and encouraging him to talk. There were long periods of time when Mike was suffering with his own pain, and as he searched for answers, he had little energy left to provide me with much assurance about our relationship.
Although I thought the LDS temple was the place for Rhonda and me to be married, I did not, and this is a key issue, I think, for me anyway, I did not consider my feelings for her dependent upon LDS temple doctrine. I wanted to be married to Rhonda simply because I loved her and I wanted to be with her, not because of the temple. I really like the idea of marital covenants, and I think the temple is a great place to make covenants. But so are chapels, synagogues, cathedrals, mosques, and maybe even a forest or a backyard. Although this view has matured over the years and at various times we have been more or less temple active, I do not consider the temple ceremonies per se as pivotal to my marriage or my salvation for that matter.
I spent months alternating between being hopeful and being afraid until I finally realized that neither hope nor fear were particularly useful in this case. As long as I was hopeful that Mike's behavior or beliefs would be a certain way, then I was crushed with disappointment each time he said or did something that suggested he might be changing and becoming different than I wanted. I found that fear crowded out my ability to love deeply. As I thought about what might help Mike, I began listening to Sunstone Symposium sessions on CD and tapes. And I listened to a session on James A. Fowler's work on Stages of Faith. Listening to this and other sessions reawakened my own spiritual journey in a very positive way. The session on Stages of Faith started me on my own odyssey of reading Fowler's works. Several books later, what I took away from Fowler was invaluable to me in overcoming my fear about Mike's doubts and questions. Fowler's work suggests that going through a stage of doubt and questioning was a normal developmental stage, and that there was hope for a better future in subsequent stages where sometimes even greater spirituality is possible. I drew comfort from this, and I began letting go of my fear and started becoming more accepting of Mike's doubts. When I began to see that his journey was a normal one and could potentially lead to a better place, it was a much better experience for both of us, and I was gradually able to allow him to follow his own faith journey, realizing that it was best if I just offered my love and support.
There's no question that Fowler had a very positive effect on Rhonda's interpretation of what I was experiencing, and it gave me some essential map coordinates as well. I agree that Fowler's stages are most useful, and perhaps only useful, for those leaving stage 3, or a conventional faith, and entering stage 4, an individualistic or independent faith. That someone, and not a Mormon, had studied this process and described a passageway out of the pit I was in was comforting. Although the faith transition process was perhaps the most painful thing I had ever done, instead of leaving the church, which many understandably have, I decided to be patient, stay the course, and trust that there was indeed something healthier beyond the bounds of where I was. Also, Rhonda's fear and grief are now more understandable to me. As she quoted Mary Beth Raines in the beginning, these issues can hit someone at the very core, like breathing. I wanted to communicate the deep love I had for Rhonda, but after nearly 30 years of marriage, to tell your wife that you have serious reservations about the Eternal Temple ritual is a big potential landmine. Most of what I experience in the temple is markedly removed from my own cosmology. Although my personal doctrine is admittedly a work in progress, so apparently is the temple ceremony. Regardless, this journey has been very beneficial to me. Having a deeper understanding of other belief systems has given me the comfort to select what I believe is important and valid Mormon doctrine and jettison the rest. When President Hinckley stated to the religious world that perhaps Mormonism could add a little something to their faith, I believe he was describing one lane of the two-lane thoroughfare. There is plenty out there in other religious traditions that I can comfortably and fearlessly add to my own personal cosmology that enhances my relationship, not only with Rhonda, but with the infinite as well. So I really think that as Rhonda became aware that even though my beliefs were undergoing some serious realignment, my commitment to her definitely was not. In the beginning, I did an inadequate job of communicating that to her. I think now she understands it better. And the key issue to me now is that we are both traveling on this journey, and it is much more satisfying.
At this point in time, I think we both agree that Mike's journey has been a positive experience for our relationship. For a number of years, we hadn't talked a lot about what we believed. As long as we thought we believed the same thing, there wasn't a lot to discuss. But after Mike shared his concern with me, this led to many long talks about what and why we believed. I thrive on talking about important ideas. Once I was able to get past my fear, this deep disclosure helped us experience times of great closeness and bonding. These conversations rejuvenated my own spiritual journey. I've enjoyed thinking more deeply about what I believe and why. And now, rather than worrying about whether we're on divergent paths in our spiritual journeys, I recognize that we're both on journeys and we can share our experience with each other. They're different journeys, but they can draw us closer, and it has been a positive learning experience. And now we'll transition to Paige and Tom. Mike's church activity changed only modestly as he was going through the reevaluation of his beliefs, but I think the next two couples had more changes in their church activity.
In the Mormon narrative, Adam and Eve are placed in the Garden of Eden and given a catch-22. God commanded them to multiply and replenish the earth, and yet not to partake of the tree of the fruit of the knowledge of good and evil. But the problem was that they couldn't do both. Adam was a bulldog of faithfulness and obedience to God. But in the garden, where was that getting him? Nowhere. For me, the real hero of this story is Eve. On her own, she chose knowledge, and Adam was finally forced to make a choice. And here we are. Paige and I have been married for almost 17 years. We met in Virginia while I was interviewing for a federal job. Paige was a nanny for a Catholic family in Vienna, Virginia. I had only been home from my mission to Alabama for less than a year and recently moved to the Washington, D.C. area. At church, I bumped into an acquaintance from my hometown in Utah. This acquaintance got the sense that I didn't know too many people and insisted that she send someone to pick me up at my apartment so that I could hang out with her and her friends for videos and popcorn. Paige was that chauffeur. I was a dyed-in-the-wool, zealot Mormon from a conservative LDS family. Paige was from San Pete, Utah, and was raised with conservative small-town traditions and from a family that had a wonderful mix of liberal, fundamentalist Mormonism. I think Paige's father, Jim, liked me as we became acquainted. Even then, I was steeped in Mormon books and minutiae, and Jim was more than capable of keeping up in our conversations. In time, I found that there were plenty of topics that I could speak to my father-in-law about that I wasn't able to with my own father. I currently feel a sense of loss now that my father-in-law and I don't seem capable of having a civil religious conversation. I understand that early in his marriage, he felt a sense of unworthiness if not judged by some of his in-laws. Now I feel this way about him, but I accept the fact that it's my own fault. I'm moving towards agnosticism, and Jim's moving the other direction. To make a long story short, I've worked in the Mormon book trade for 11 years now, and I feel that it's natural for someone in the book trade to find moments of cognitive dissonance. And when these moments are allowed to work their course, I feel that they will eventually lead to glimpses of honest clarity. Not to say that these glimpses are moments of truth, but instances in life when one realizes that something isn't the same anymore and never will be again. The God of my Mormonism died in one of those moments. And if and when I ever find God again, it simply will be something else. My poor wife, she bargained for a hard-working, clean-cut Eagle Scout returned missionary with a Mormon pedigree. Instead, she got me. I can remember that by the late 1990s, I was essentially embarrassed by my Mormonism, and I wasn't happy attending church. In fact, I was really quite angry and felt betrayed. Paige seemed very frustrated with my doubts, and I felt that my church service had become a duty to her rather than anything for myself. While working at the bookstore, Dan Witherspoon introduced me to James Fowler and stage theory. I've spoken about my experiences with stage theory in past symposiums, and in brief, stage theory has allowed me in time to make peace with my Mormonism, and I've actually found my ward and my elders' quorum to be a sanctuary for my re-emerging spirituality. Paige offered me some advice once. She mentioned that church is where people go to get spiritually recharged, and it isn't a place for me to detract from that. I've strived sometimes unsuccessfully to contribute positively at church, and to my surprise, I've found that my elders' quorum has been kind and responsive. In certain circumstances, I've tried to be honest and respectful in expressing that I have serious doubts about all of it. I've also tried not to vent at people who are passing folklorist history or at those who most likely don't have the tools to yet deal with the serious credibility problems facing Mormonism. But for me to walk away from my tradition now would be spitting in the face of men who have gone out of their way to make me feel comfortable and welcome at church, despite my doubts. To me, the most brutal aspect of doubt is in a marriage is that spouses don't often go through them together. In our case, I wanted to vent my frustrations about our tradition to my closest friend, Paige. But that only contributed stress to an already strained marriage due to the normal issues of parenting, finances, and such. Not to mention my own poor communication skills and, of course, the Kimball temper. As I've watched my friends go through their doubts, it appears that it can often take about 10 years for someone to fully move through the various maturing processes. I think I deal with my doubt and other people's lack of doubt much better now than I did 10 years ago. But to go from then till now left a fair amount of carnage behind me. I credit Paige for allowing me to get from then till now with our marriage intact. Unfortunately, just as I'm finding my way off the rapids, Paige appears to have launched her boat upstream, and all I seem to be able to do is advise her to hang on, as I'm not yet totally on shore myself. Earlier this year, when Paige decided to attend another church, I have to admit that inside, I felt betrayed. When I wanted to move on, I didn't. I stayed. I gripped my teeth, and I suffered. I don't mind so much that Paige found spiritual rejuvenation in another tradition. I just don't know what to do with our children. I've listened to Paige's complaints, and I see most of the same inherent problems in those other traditions as in our own. I feel that in the long run, she will be only trading one set of problems for another. I see a lot of strength in the youth programs of our tradition, including the scouting program, which I'm actively involved in. What does a couple do when there doesn't seem to be any answers, and our local spiritual advisors, parents, and many of our friends can't really understand our individual dilemmas nor those we face as a couple? There are no guidelines. There are no easy answers, and we're on our own. We're told that if our children grow up without the gospel in their lives, that our sons will become drug addicts and our daughters will be trailer trash. Yet I see plenty of faithful, active Latter-day Saints with dysfunctional families. I recently spent some time with my oldest daughter, and it occurs to me that some of my kids are already smarter than I am. I can't imagine that these kids won't come face to face with the same intellectual dilemmas with regards to their Mormonism that Paige and I are now facing. At some point in their emerging adulthood, they're going to have to ask themselves, I wonder what Dad did for a living. And will their cognitive dissonance cause them to become hoods and whores? I pray that Paige and I are trailblazing and not bridge burning for our children. My hope is that seeing their folks struggle with such things while attempting to find ways to repair our marriage will give them strength to heal their own souls and the courage to persevere with their relationships with their partners. The dilemma of doubt is that we can place at risk the relationships with our partners often at a time when there are other corrosive influences such as school, employment, finances, in-laws, child rearing, personal maturation, already pulling at these relationships. In my doubt, I see Paige going about this the best way she knows how. Knowledge, for all of its benefits, has its costs. I'm sure that Mother Eve was unsure as to the results of her choice, but alas, she understood one thing. There would be pain, death, heartache, and sorrow, but in the end, there was no other way.
I don't know if I have any answers to the burning questions about how to deal with this whole subject, and I certainly can't say that what has helped us will help everyone. All I can do is share our story in hopes that within our story there are pieces that may be of benefit to you. And our story began way before I met Tom. When I was baptized at 8 years old, my father was in the bishopric. And it wasn't long after that time that my father started to not attend churches regularly, and he quit going to the temple altogether. The hardest part for me was I didn't understand what was going on in his head and why he stopped believing. Unfortunately, he didn't answer any of these questions for me. I guess he felt he was protecting my faith, or maybe it was out of respect for my mother, who was a staunch believer and was desperately trying to keep us children active and faithful in the church. I spent my youth hearing about temple marriages and eternal families, and I knew I didn't have one. In my naive mind, I assumed it was because my father didn't care enough about us to want to be with us for eternity. And I think this kind of jaded me in a sense, because after that, I was just bound and determined to marry somebody whose faith was strong and whose testimony was unshakable. I wasn't going to be the woman dragging her children to church alone, praying every day that her husband would see the light, and feeling alone in my worship of God. Enter Thomas Kimball. Spiritually, he was everything I had ever wanted in an eternal companion. His enthusiasm for learning about the church and the gospel was infectious. You couldn't be around him without wanting to learn more for yourself. And when he talked about the temple and the mysteries that were discussed therein, his face would light up and he would just say to me, "Paige, I can't wait for you to go. It's magical. It's great." When we read the scriptures together, he had a way of helping bring out information that I had never thought of, or he would help me see a passage like I had never understood it before. Spiritually, I felt like he was lifting me to a higher ground. So when Thomas first started talking about his doubts, I was annoyed, and that annoyance quickly became anger, and then it became fear. The more he tried to talk to me, the more I distanced myself. I didn't want to hear his doubts. I hadn't read all the books that he had read, and I didn't know how to respond to his accusations of abuse and untruths within Mormonism. I kept thinking that he's just listening to the wrong people, reading the wrong books, and at that time, I really didn't like Sunstone. I remember one day blowing up and saying to him, "If you don't believe in it, then why are you still going to church?" And immediately, I wanted to take those words back because I thought, oh my gosh, I'm going to push him into inactivity. And his response was, he was just trying to figure it all out. And couldn't I just understand? But unfortunately, I didn't possess the ability to do that for him at the time. About this same time, he started to work at Benchmark Books. he and Dan Witherspoon would have lengthy conversations. Needless to say, I wasn't crazy about Dan either at the time, because I thought he was leading Tom down a slippery slope. However, with time, I came to realize that Dan could be the sounding board that I couldn't be for Tom. Tom needed someone to talk with, and being in this environment of Benchmark gave that to him, whether it was his coworkers or the customers. And although I wanted Tom to be able to talk to me, every time he did, I became agitated and angry. It became easier for him just not to talk to me. I felt like the little girl again, and I just didn't understand why he didn't love me enough to just believe. For me, couldn't he just put all of his doubts aside and believe? Well, as many of you know, it just doesn't work that way. Thomas and I were being torn up inside, both of us seeking for a connection, a sense of understanding, and a trust that the other one couldn't provide. And I remember sitting through multiple lessons on how we should rid evil influences from our lives, how we should not listen to those that would destroy your testimony. And I remember thinking, but what if that influence is in your home? What do you do when the person who's poisoning your testimony is your spouse? Do I just get rid of him? I can't just throw him away like a book or stop spending time with him like an acquaintance. I don't remember exactly when it happened, but one day I realized that I needed to stop looking at Tom through the church's eyes. Because when I judged him according to the church, he was failing miserably. He was not leading our family in family prayer, family home evening, scripture study. He had stopped going to the temple. He was, by all accounts, a poor Mormon husband. But I started looking at him differently, and I realized he was an incredible man. He loved me and the children with a steadfast, deep love. He supported me in my dreams and my goals. He had integrity. He was honest. He was sexy. He was funny. He was intelligent and charismatic. And suddenly, I loved him for who he was and not for who I wanted him to be. I decided to stop looking at all the things I thought he wasn't and focus on the things that he was. The thing is that in doing so, I started to let go of the church. I had spent years watching my mother practice her religion alone. I didn't have the strength or the desire to do the same. I realized that holding on to the church's definition of marriage and a priesthood holder was driving a wedge between us. I felt I had to choose, in a sense, between the church and my marriage. Some women can balance the two, but I couldn't. I had to let go of all my preconceived notions of how a marriage partner should be and start celebrating the beauty within our relationship. I started really listening to Thomas and his issues about the church. I read some of the same articles in the books that he had read. And before this time, if I read anything, I was really able to just dismiss it as a problem with the authorship. You know, the author had an axe to grind, or they were being immoral, and that led him away from the Spirit. I mean, I had a whole bunch of reasons why what I read I didn't have to really listen to. But by this time, I had met a lot of the authors that I was now reading, and I knew them to be some of the most moral thinking individuals that I had met. I couldn't easily dismiss their words, and for the first time, I decided to look at the church objectively. It wasn't long before I had some of the same issues and questions that Tom had. I think it's funny that throughout all of this, we have remained relatively active in our ward. We seemed to teeter-totter in what we should do about our beliefs. When he was frustrated and wanted to quit attending church, I still felt like there was a place for me, that I could help people that were struggling just like me. Then when I decide that I want to throw in the towel, that I can't stand another Sunday learning about obedience, Tom wants to go and feels that it's important to continue attending. At the beginning of this year, I felt like I wasn't getting anything out of my Sunday worship at the Mormon church, so I began attending other churches. I found a quaint little Bible church where I loved the preacher's sermons. When I left the services, I felt rejuvenated and inspired to do better and be a better person. The sermons focused on real life issues, not just tithing, temple attendance, the faith of the pioneers, or following the prophet. And there wasn't condemnations for imperfections. The people there didn't profess to have all the answers. They all were just seeking for a connection with their God, just like I was. Thanks. I really liked the Unitarian Church's welcome, which said, "Welcome everyone, male and female, black and white, no matter your beliefs or whom you choose to love. All are welcome here. Wow, I thought, a church that accepts everyone as they are? What a novel concept. But wouldn't you know, now Tom feels completely comfortable in his elders' quorum. He has found a way to balance his disbelief, which he openly admits to other class members, and his feelings of belonging. I don't really want to separate our family into two different religions. And because he was willing to go all those years for me, I feel I can do the same for him now. Although I have found other things in the churches that I like better, I'm trying to look for the good within mine again. I've decided it's not about the religion, it's about the relationship with God. The upside of this whole process is that Tom and I no longer have to hide our true feelings, afraid that we'll hurt the other one. We can be angry, sad, or just laugh together at some of the quirkiness within our church. In a sense, we have bonded in our frustrations regarding our religion. However, although we sense spiritualism in our own lives, we don't share spiritualism within our relationship. I would like to change this. Whether it's through meditation, reading books, talking, or whatever, I think both of us are longing for this, but we're still searching separately. It's hard to make the shift because we have become comfortable in our relationship right now, and reaching for something new means opening ourselves and our beliefs up for criticism from the other partner. It's easy to define what you mutually don't believe or you mutually believe. It's harder to express a heartfelt belief that the other doesn't share. And although I realize we do not have to have the same respects, our beliefs to respect each other, Tom's opinion means a lot to me, and I just don't want to recreate the chasm that we've had between us. We are here to introduce ourselves, tell our story, and answer the question if our relationship is better or worse since John left the church 5 years ago. And we have decided to do this by sharing a dialogue that John and I actually had and typed out with some editing. So it's really raw, and I hope it comes out okay.
I'll start. I grew up in the Midwest. My parents converted when I was 3. I always felt that the church was an integral part of me. That is, until I met you, whose identity really was integrated with your church membership. I didn't appreciate that until after I left the church. I realized that my church membership had always been a choice for me, a voluntary association and not so much a part of me. I don't mean to say that my commitment to the church was in any way shallow. It's just that I didn't identify it with my being, in contrast to you. I felt like I was adopted into the fold, but you were there by birthright.
Yeah, we have since realized that the difference is in the way we were a part of the church. I was born into a family that had ancestral Mormon roots on both sides. I was raised in Utah and now understand how the church was a big part of my identity. From my family of origin to my religion to the geographical culture that I was raised in, I was Mormon to the core. And I often say it's in my DNA. I've heard that said before. I, of course, didn't really know this either until we moved to Indiana, and I noticed how different Mormons could be.
And I don't like to talk about this in this way because it seems to imply that it was easier for me to leave because I wasn't a Utah Mormon. But if I'm honest with myself, I think that's probably true. That's not to say that it was easy for me to leave, especially because I was married at the time.
You mean married with ties to a Utah Mormon?
Yeah, partly because you were Utah Mormon, and partly because of the way that you viewed our spiritual development as a joint endeavor.
Well, I'm still a little baffled by the fact that you didn't think it was a joint endeavor. I mean, can you explain how you escaped the paradigm in the Mormon church with its doctrines about achieving salvation as a family?
Yes. Of course, we believed in eternal families, but it's not like we believed that one spouse was going to be damned if the other one is. We believe that the spouse that's left behind will be given a worthy spouse in the afterlife if the one in this life doesn't make it. I've always believed and still believe that we are alone with God in the most fundamental sense. I mean, even if you don't believe in God or if you believe in a void, you ultimately have to face that alone. People can help you, but no one can do it for you. I don't believe in group salvation or the notion that we are saved or damned together. Does that answer your question?
No, because I'm very offended by the idea that I would be given to another and not being able to be with the spouse of my choice. That doesn't sound like any type of heaven that I would choose.
But as I understood it, once you got to heaven, you would choose it because you wouldn't want to be separated from the presence of God.
Well, I don't want to be married to God. I choose you. I want to be a God with you.
And I screwed that up.
Yes. And no. I mean, yes, you screwed that up because I feel you have left me to be alone in a journey of spiritual growth that was to be ours to create together. And no, you didn't screw that up because I do not believe that I will be given to another or choose another. I think that heaven is about being with our families. We choose our families of creation here and we will choose them there. Mormons believe in eternal progression, so we will have eternity to progress and become gods anyway.
And here we come back to our common theological debate about whether there's upward movement between the degrees of glory in the post-life or whether there's any kind of glass ceiling.
Yes, I understand that I make up doctrines to fit my preferences and my issues. But so does everybody else.
And here we are at another critical difference in the way that you see being Mormon and the way that I see it. I grant that you always had the history and perhaps even embraced the lifestyles and the standards more fully than I did. But I don't think you ever have taken the doctrine as seriously as I did. And even now, as you play fast and loose with it, I can see why you did not understand why I left. Because for me, in and out of the church, it has always been about the doctrine.
Well, no, it wasn't. I mean, you were making the doctrine fit your life, and when it didn't fit anymore, you rejected it.
I'll agree with you that I was creating my own version of doctrine as everyone else does. You cannot avoid interpretation, but you can do it more or less consciously. And I think I've always placed more value than you did on at least trying to preserve the integrity of the doctrine, meaning I was trying to get it right as opposed to just picking or choosing. For me, it was all or nothing. So I had to consciously manipulate some doctrines as I got closer to the crisis point when I left.
Well, it's that all or nothing attitude that precedes apostasy.
And I will agree with you on that, but I think we're off topic a bit.
What's the topic?
The topic is our relationship.
Well, the issues we have discussed are symbolic. We've already discussed are symbolic of the emotions and insecurities in our relationship. I mean, as the story goes, I remember we went to get our temple recommends renewed, and you were the young men's president at the time, and I was a counselor in the Relief Society. We had recently read some controversial readings together, and I knew you were coming to terms with some of the church's tainted history. I had no idea you would come out of that temple recommend interview without a recommend and having been asked to be released. I thought, okay, this is fine. John just needs to work some things out. But looking back, I don't know why I was surprised when much later you finally told me that you had given the branch president a letter listing the reasons why you do not believe in Mormonism anymore and then asked to have your name removed from the records. But that in the moment that you told me, it was as if you had just punched me terribly hard in the stomach. I remember I doubled over, I couldn't breathe, I was disoriented, and I didn't know if I should hit you, collapse, or just get the hell out of the apartment. I mean, I remember thinking, what does this mean as far as what I'm supposed to do now? I had dated non-members, and I had made a choice long ago that I wanted a priesthood holder. I wanted the possibility of going on a mission as an elderly couple. I wanted a Mormon family, and I did not want this. I was thinking, doubts, fine, struggle, fine, but give up, leave? Who are you now? This is not what I choose. And I have later come to appreciate the fictitious person I had created and called husband. I mean, in a very real sense, I needed to get to know you, maybe for the first time. So we had to start over again, didn't we?
Yes, we did. We had assumed that we knew certain things about each other because of our joint commitment to the church, not realizing that we were committed for very different reasons and in very different ways. I remember feeling like I had made one of the most authentic choices of my life, and I was really being myself truly for the first time. And I saw your reaction to my leaving as a rejection of who I was, at least when I stopped trying to be something that I wasn't. I mean, I wasn't blindsided by your reaction. I saw it coming, and that's why I put off telling you, largely because I was afraid you would talk me out of it. I was afraid what my reaction would be when faced with the choice between being true to myself or being true to my family.
So even though you were not surprised by my reaction, you still felt betrayed as well?
Yes. That's ironic, I know. I didn't even know who I was at the point or what I was going to do next, but I felt like the little piece of myself that I had carved out of the church's mold had absolutely no respect for. So you became, for a time, almost an enemy to me. Because my love for you compelled me to compromise the little integrity I felt that I had achieved. When I did that, I hated myself, and I hated you. And I guess that's how love has turned into hate. Fortunately, we did not stay there.
Yeah, I hated you too. I could only think of me and what you were doing to me. I did not see your struggle. I only saw how my marriage was being sabotaged. And I had to make a decision if I wanted to stay married to you or not. And I began seeing ways that you're an amazing man, separate from having to be an amazing as a priesthood holder. You were a great lover, a great father. You had goals and ambition. You really cared about me. And I knew you cared about me because you listened to me and you allowed me to hurt. And I made the decision that I wanted you with or without your membership. That was big. But I think my love for you, and in doing so, my love for you deepened because it seemed more real. I mean, I'm not just playing the Mormon wife role by loving you. I was Ruth in love with John, no roles necessary. I was still angry and hurt, though. I still had a lot of questions about how are we going to raise our family now? What will our family look like as far as spiritual rituals that have been important to me? They've always been important.
Yeah, once you realized that I was not going back to the church, you had to ask, okay, well, what kind of family religious life are we going to create together? I, however, was still working out what kind of religious life I wanted to live by myself, which I felt needed to be worked out first. And we have thought about that for a while, about the priority of those two questions.
I remember continuing to be baffled by your lack of family integration into your spiritual development. And I was annoyed by your lack of consideration of how this family of our creation was to move in any direction without you.
And we're still working that one out.
Yeah. But I remember a significant turning point for me in our relationship. I remember asking myself, why in the hell? Can I say that? It's unstoppable.
I think you're okay.
Why in the hell am I waiting for John to come up with the spiritual map for our family? I have my own life, my own spirituality, and my own talents that I can share with our children without him. I never wanted to be alone in this, but I was. I was not going to whine any longer and pine for your attention to take some initiative in spiritual matters. I was making a hard and hurtful decision to let go of my expectation that you lead this family in spiritual rituals. But this was a decision. This decision was one that was ultimately healthy for our relationship. This decision was not made out of anger or resentment in response to you, but for once I was deciding for me. I felt suddenly powerful and amazingly capable. I did not tell you about this decision until later because at the time it felt so good not to include you. I was on my way of being free from you.
And I remember when you did tell me, I felt on the one hand relieved and excited because I didn't think the level of dependence that we had had in that area was healthy for either of us. On the other hand, it felt like another rejection of me, which I suppose it was, and that hurt.
Well, it wasn't so much a rejection of you as much as a rejection of the expectation that you be the one to take the initiative in religious and spiritual matters for our family. I mean, I didn't feel dependent on you as much as I just depended on you to be my partner in this.
Now we are doing a much better job of negotiating and compromising on the details of how we are going to raise our children. Now you are in school and you have a career of your own ahead of you and you have interests and goals and a whole life independent of me. And I feel both proud of you and relieved that I'm not responsible for your spiritual life. There's no doubt that you and I are stronger as individuals for having been through this struggle, that we are more whole, more integral as individuals. And I have to believe, that being stronger individuals, we will be stronger as a couple.
I think we are stronger as a couple because we're stronger as individuals. I mean, we're not as threatened by our differences now. We can disagree or agree with each other without having to take it so personal. And you have always been my biggest supporter of going for my goals, in spite of what some may consider the selfish nature of them. And you have been a good example of living an authentic life, leaving the church being one of those authentic decisions. And I will always be grateful to you for showing me that I must be who I want to be, and everyone else will just have to catch up. You stayed with me, and I'm so glad that you did not outgrow me and leave me, not necessarily the church, but leave me.
There are times, though, that I feel very distant from you, and I miss you. And I know that's ironic, because for years I've been wanting to disentangle our relationship. But sometimes I fear that we don't have enough bonds anymore to make it through. I wonder, how are we to maintain our hard-won autonomy and preserve our relationship? When I was in the church, I think we were lazy because we assumed that we had the church and the church lifestyle in common. Now I mourn for that loss, for the loss of that feeling of closeness that came from that shared commitment, even if it was an illusion. The saying goes, all knowledge leads away from some Garden of Eden, and I suppose that's true in marriage as in the rest of life.
I miss you too. I miss sharing the stupid religious symbols that have meaning to me. And I wish you would share more of what symbolizes spirituality to you. I guess we're at a point where we want to share more, but we do not want to go back to relying on each other for anything. And I think that's a loss for us.
Lately, to be honest, that sense of loss has been getting the best of me. Mike talked about wanting to excise a whole portion of your history, and I feel that too. And when that feeling gets the best of me, I try to remind myself of a favorite quote from Look Back in Anger, a play. It's no good trying to fool yourself about love. You can't fall into it like a soft job without dirtying your hands. It takes muscle and guts. And if you can't bear the thought of messing up your nice, clean soul, you'd better give up the whole idea of life and become a saint, because you'll never make it as a human being. It's either this life or the next.
I've always liked that quote too.
When I left the church, I gave up on the idea of being a saint in both senses of the word, and I chose this life, messy and dirty as it is. You are a huge part of that life. You are an example to me of the kind of muscle and guts it takes to really live life, and I'm glad I have you to share it with.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone.
Okay, now we'd like to open it up for questions.
I would just like to thank each of you for your intimacy. The one reason I like funerals is because there are things you don't learn about people when they're living, and I appreciate you exposing yourselves while you're living. Thank you.
I am the facilitator that you referred to at the last session. So I just want to say how impressed I am by your honesty and your willingness to encounter fear and truly look past stereotypes to see the other human being in front of you, despite your expectations being dashed. My people in my group would love to hear what you're hearing from your spouses. It is the most heart-wrenching, difficult thing for a human being to have the experience that the person they love the most is not willing to look at them and see them, whether they agree with them or not. So I commend you for being able to walk into that fear with each other and that authenticity. And I think that only in being willing to encounter that do you grow up to be fully human. So thank you for what you've done. I'd like to ask also, the next problem that people have is with their extended family. And usually what they find from their extended family is politeness and no willingness to engage in real conversation and not wanting to hear what's in the heart. How do you get along with your extended family, and is this a problem for you?
Yeah, extended family. That's a trick. It's kind of like my elder's quorum. To some guys, I'm a project. To others, there's fear. And to even others, there's, hey, let's see how he goes through it, and then maybe I'll go through it. I feel really bad too because I lost recently one of my advocates in my family who died of cancer. And, he used to sort of behind the scenes stick up for me with my in-laws and some of my extended family. And when he left, and he would also tell me what was going on, what was being said behind my back, and when I lost him, that was a pretty big blow for me. We have a pact that, if there's an afterlife, that we would contact each other, so I'm still waiting. it's not just your extended family, but it's also your neighborhood. As a Latter-day Saint who's going through doubt, you run the risk of, especially if you're living in Utah, you can put everything at risk. You can put your employment at risk. You put your status in the neighborhood at risk. You put, my relationship with my mom. I want my mom to understand, but I also don't want to put my mom's also close to 80, and I also don't want to necessarily put things in her way. Gee whiz, she went this long, let's leave her alone, sort of thing, there's a lot of dilemmas like that. I want my mom to understand, to understand why I've got a ponytail and this, that, and the other. And it has nothing to do with sin or any of that. It's just, I'm a midlife crisis and I can't afford the car, in the elders' quorum too, here I am, I'm not only changing my theology, I'm changing my politics and everything. It's tough wanting them to understand, but also not wanting to create, after going through this, is a very painful process, and not wanting to create artificially this process for them, not to be the cause yourself, even though unfortunately that's going to be the case in some ways.
Yeah, I'd just like to, just very quickly, I think that if you can temper, or I have found in my life with my neighbors and my family, I'm fortunate in that in my side of the family, they are very interested in everything that I have to say about this journey, because many of them have been on their own journey their whole life. But yet everyone is still moderately, if not totally, active in the church. But for those others, I have found that if I temper my statements that could be very bothersome with things that I really still believe in. I am a born-again home teacher. I think it is the best thing that we do in the church. I really do. And when I go, I home teach a CES. He's a TBM in every sense of the word, and I love him to death. I love his family. But if you tell somebody that this is what I do believe in, I believe in home teaching. I believe in, that is something you're supposed to do, and I enjoy it. And then tell them that, if there's something else that you have a problem with, it tempers that. And so I think that if there is some sort of a balance that you can do, it sure helps, especially with the family. Let them know that you're not totally a wasted project at that point.
This is Tom again for the tape, sorry. One other point, I heard someone talk last night, and they said something I thought, I'd be looking for the right words for a year, and this person just rattled it off. But within my family and within my neighborhood and within even in some ways in our marriage, I found that I'm striving to carve out was the word that was used, carve out an existence for myself within my ward. And I'm actively doing it. Through service and through goodwill and through trying to be positive in spite of my doubts and so forth, that I'm carving out a place for myself within my community. And I'm creating something for myself. And I think if I don't do that, then I'll just be ignored and forgotten. But as I carve out this niche and this place for myself within my community and within my family, that I'm finding a place for myself. Anyway.
This question may be slightly related to what you were just talking about. Several of you mentioned how Fowler's Stages of Faith helped you personally in a spiritual journey. I'm wondering if, as that journey progresses, either in the context of Fowler or in your own journey, what is it that helped you to negotiate your own personal faith and being able to express that in the context of your life and relationships, particularly your closest relationships? Does Fowler have anything to say on how to spiritually deal with other people? Are there other theories or even something you may, you know, theories, something that's worked for you, either spiritually or in some kind of framework that's worked best for you?
I'm going to try and respond directly to that question, but I, along with the other panelists, James Fowler was very helpful for me, if for no other reason than to look back at the time when I was very dogmatic and very exclusive in my attitude in the church, and look back and forgive myself of being that way when I was in the church. But I would express this caution because I experienced it too. And when I left the church, Tom and I frequently, when we were together, would talk about these stages of faith and where we would speculate, where would we put ourselves and so forth. The absolute worst thing to do is to suggest that your spouse is on a lower level. Not good. And I would also say it's good to approach his stages with a certain degree of flexibility, because I've always believed that Ruth somehow managed to skip a few stages. And she, ironically, since the time I've known her, has always been very liberal and inclusive and open-minded in her beliefs, and has been a model for me in that way. And to tell you the truth, I'm still striving to be like her in that way.
I'd like to address that too. One of the ways I read Fowler is that as you progress through stages, your capacity to love more broadly increases, and that looking at interacting with people around you, the more that you can do that with a heart full of love, then the more positive the interactions can be. And if you're looking at them with a judgmental, I'm at a more advanced stage than you are, it's going to go across very poorly. But if your heart is truly full of love, then I think it helps you.
There's Tom again. Paige grabbed my legs. Stop. I'm not here to hear you. You know, Fowler's been really important to me. For me, you know, the thing that Dan Witherspoon kept lecturing me on was that, Tom, stages of faith aren't real things, okay? The stages aren't real, because I kept trying to make them tangible and solid. They're things that you can kind of glom along with. You can be in a couple stages at a time. On your best day, you're probably a stage six, whereas on your worst day, you could be a two. You know, it's just the way it works. But the thing for me with regards to Fowler is that it gave me a perspective on life, and that gave me hope that here I'm sitting in, I can no longer conceive of God, and yet I have these people whom I trust, who have authentic religious and spiritual experiences within the framework of my home tradition. And I trust, and Fowler allowed me to trust these people that their experiences were authentic and that they weren't just having chemistry in their brain that was giving them the spiritual experiences, that it was authentic, and they were finding peace with not only the same problems that I was finding within my tradition, but they were coming to peace with it, and not only coming to peace with it, but their spirituality was growing. It's sort of that day when you've spent your whole life putting those little hard questions up on the shelf, and you put them up one at a time, and the day finally becomes when you're mature enough that you can take them all down and unpack them and have a good look at them, and you can still swim within your tradition. And Fowler gave me that, and it's a great gift. Thank you.
I first learned about Sunstone in the late 80s when I was at a conference in Colorado from M. Scott Peck, whom some of you may know about. And I had just finished reading his book, The Different Drum, and he was talking about stages of community. And he said, "Do you know about Sunstone?" Well, first of all, he told me, you know, the Mormon Church, when I made it known to him that I was Mormon, he said, "Well, I see the Mormon Church at stage one in his four stages of pseudo-community." He's talking about community, four stages of community. Stage one, pseudo, false community. People are not willing to tell the truth. They smile a lot, but they don't tell the truth. Then but to begin to work your way to the true stage, which is the fourth stage in his scheme of things. But you can't get there before you go through stage two, which he calls chaos. When someone has the guts to speak, like, "I hate this stuff," or whatever, the truth of the emotional truth, the intellectual truth, whatever, the chaos begins. And it moves to the third stage where he said, the example of Sunstone is at a third stage level where you empty it out. You put it all on the table. You're not afraid to speak about what's true. But he says many of the top leaders of the church are afraid that their membership in the movement to fourth stage or true community will get stuck in Sunstone at the third stage. I want to congratulate you for bringing us to a fourth stage, true community here. Thank you.
Have any of you, through either of your experiences, come in contact with or met others of other faith traditions who have dealt with the same issues, and do you see any similarities?
We didn't hear the question.
The question was, have we met others of other faiths that have gone through similar issues? And we're all shaking our heads, no. We know Mormons who've left and gone to other faiths, who've gone to similar issues. Fowler's work interviewed over 600 people, and he claims that going through these stages happens in any faith, including atheists. A family that's raising their children atheists, their children still have to, at some point, will reevaluate and decide if they are atheists or not. So there's some evidence that it happens in every faith.
I haven't had a personal experience with someone who has left their faith, but Ruth and I both read a book that was helpful. It was called Leaving the Fold, and it's not the same Leaving the Fold book that's published by Signature Books. It's another book about Christian fundamentalists who leave their religion. And Marnie Williams? Marlene Williams. It was helpful to me to hear a voice from another tradition, someone who went through a similar experience. And Ruth told me that it was helpful for her to appreciate what I was going through from a more neutral perspective. So I would recommend that if anyone is interested.
have a quick question. I noticed that those of you that have gone through this journey and have left are men, and so I'm wondering if you know of people or if you know statistics, if there are Mormon women who, I mean, I'm sure there are, but I was just curious. It was just odd that the whole panel was men leaving, and I also saw these men rush up to ask questions. So, what are you coming up to answer?
Yeah.
Okay, fine.
I didn't want to cut you off, though. Did you want to say anything more? Okay. My home teacher's wife left the church, and I invited him to be on this panel, but she didn't want to be, and so he didn't want to. She didn't. Yes, there's women who leave the church, and the men who are very faithful and bring their kids to church without the wives. It's very hard on them as well. They have to go through the same exact process, I would assume. Maybe it's not exactly the same. Maybe there's a difference for a priesthood holder. I don't know if there's more stigma. I don't know if it's harder. But I would assume it's basically the same. Also, no one actually has left the church on this panel but John, am I right? And Rhonda, you could have easily left the church. Paige, you're considering it as we speak. So it's not just men leaving the church.
I don't know any statistics. Molly Bennion recently published a dialogue article called My Lament about her sadness about all her female friends that have left. It does happen. There was a Sunstone session 2 years ago about a woman who left and became Quaker, and her husband continued to take their children to the LDS church. In just looking around, it appears that men are more likely to initiate the questioning and doubts, but it's not unusual for, as Paige did, if the wife opens up to those questions and fears, to watch couples leave together. So there's a whole mix of things going on. I don't have statistics. I can't give you definite answers.
I was brought up in an entirely different tradition, the Pentecostal. And I had a deep, deep conversion experience in my soul when I was 9. I wanted to be baptized, but they told me that I was too young because I couldn't understand what that meant. But I insisted and I was baptized. Then I heard a lot of talk about love, but I didn't see the manifestation of it. I heard a lot of talk about being tolerant and loving to other people, and I heard a lot of criticism. I heard a lot of condemnation of other kind of religions, and Mormonism was the worst. And at age of 14, I was baptized at 10, and it meant a lot to me, and I became a disciple of Jesus. At 14, I left the church because I felt that the organized religions became systems that glorified themselves, and I didn't want it. So, but I went with Jesus, the Holy Spirit. It took me 30 years before I realized that I meet Christians everywhere, and I had a horrifying fantasy or experience emotionally where I felt that I was sinking in a deep well, and or I fell in it, and there was this rope that I suddenly caught onto before I reached the water at the bottom. And I tried, this is what I experienced emotionally, I tried to pull myself back up somehow or other. I fought this doubt and the guilt and that was put on me by church and people, and finally I was so tired and I began to slip down and I felt the end of the rope and I panicked. I'm not going to be able to hold on. I'm going to fall down into the pit, whatever that was down there. Finally, I let go. and I fell 2 inches to the bottom, and that's where God caught me. And that's all I wanted to tell you.
I was just wondering about what your expected fears about the effect on the kids versus actual effects on the kids.
This is Paige for the tape. Our kids are still pretty young. They range from 13 to 7, but my daughter, who is 11, has heard me talking a few times, and she's heard me talk about women and mother in heaven and the priesthood and why don't women have the priesthood. And I've heard my 11-year-old say, why don't women have the priesthood? And she's coming up and she's saying some of these things, and she's asking some of the questions that I never asked at that age because I just never got it. My sister, Ruth is my sister, by the way, if you couldn't tell, we look very similar. But my sister always had those questions. She always asked those. I never did. I thought that was interesting, growing up in the same house, that we didn't have the same questions. But I see my 11-year-old daughter questioning and having some of these questions now. So I know there's an effect on her. She sees her mother saying things. She hears her dad saying things. There is an effect on her. I'd love to pretend there isn't, but there's an effect on all of our kids. But Tom was really true when he said that in some ways they're smarter than we are. And I'm hoping that the difference is where my father didn't talk to me, didn't explain anything, didn't say anything to me, maybe by us being more open, more honest, talking a little bit more, explaining that even though their primary teacher told them something that we absolutely don't agree with, if we say, well, you can, you know, you don't have to believe everything you're told. You can decide if you want to believe it or not. I'm hoping that they'll come out stronger, better thinkers for it, that they don't have to believe everything that they're told.
This is Mike for the tape. To a larger or greater extent, think that it's important for the children, our children anyway, to be able to see things when they're young in a more black and white fashion. I think that it's a developmental thing. And it's not that I hide things from them, but we're fortunate in that I went through the majority of my storm, if you will, later on. My oldest daughter is, how old? 28. My youngest is a little blonde Rastafarian that is 19 and, you know, is at a very liberal arts college. But she has had remarkable questions since she was 4 about things. But, you know, I have a daughter that thinks we're eccentric. I have another daughter who's a returned missionary. And I have another daughter who, you know, is okay with everything. And then the youngest is kind of out there. But.
What was interesting is that our youngest daughter had her faith completely fall apart about the time of her 18th birthday, which was not a long time after Mike's began his major period of doubt and questioning. What was an advantage to me is that by the time I recognized my daughter told me about her faith falling apart, I had gotten past my fear and have been able to listen and talk to her. And we've remained close. A few weeks ago, I gave her a book by a Buddhist monk, which she loved, and told me she wanted to become Buddhist. I said, that's fine, there's some similarities between Mormonism and Buddhism. But so we've continued to discuss her journey and her questions on the nature of God. And so it actually has been beneficial for her. Our other children were old enough, I think, that their faith was developed enough and that they didn't, they were not impacted by Mike's crisis, and they were young enough when I went through mine that they didn't notice that either. I did, when my oldest daughter was going went through a period of inactivity, I did hand her my 4 pages of my story that I'd written down, and she never mentioned it until about a year ago. She called me and said, well, I read that what you wrote about mother in heaven, your questions. I went, you still have that? I mean, it's only been 11 years. And asked me some questions, as she had a few questions. So I think there are positive things about. And she said she felt, growing up in our home, that it was always okay to ask questions. So that there's some positive things as well. Okay, I think we're out of time, out of tape, and we appreciate all of you coming.